Chapter 104. That the works of magicians result not only from the influence of heavenly bodies. Some there were who averred that such works as seem wonderful to us, being wrought by the magic art, are done, not by certain spiritual substances, but by the power of the heavenly bodies. This would seem to be indicated by the fact that those who practice works of this kind, observe the position of the stars and are assisted by the employment of certain herbs and other corporeal things, for the purpose, as it were, of preparing matter of lower degree to receive the influence of the celestial power. But this is in contradiction with the apparitions in the works of magicians. For as it is impossible that an intellect be formed from corporeal principles, as we proved above, it is impossible for effects that are caused exclusively by the intellectual nature to be produced by the power of a heavenly body. Now in these works of magicians, things appear that are exclusively the work of a rational nature. For instance, answers are given about stolen goods, and the like, and this could not be done except by an intelligence. Therefore it is not true that all such effects are caused by the mere power of a heavenly body. Further, speech is an act proper to the rational nature. Now in these works people appeared to men and speak to them on various matters. Therefore such things cannot be done by the mere power of heavenly bodies. If, however, someone say that these apparitions are present, not to the sensorial organ, but only to the imagination, this is, in the first place, apparently untrue. For imaginary forms do not seem real to anyone, unless his external senses be suspended, since it is not possible for a person to look on a likeness as a reality, except the natural judgments of the senses be tied. Now these conversations and apparitions are addressed to those who have free use of their external senses. Therefore these apparitions and speeches cannot be imaginary. Besides, no imaginary forms can lead a person to intellectual knowledge beyond the natural or acquired faculty of his intellect. This is evident in dreams, since even if they contain some indication of the future, it is not every dreamer that understands the meaning of his dreams. Now, in these apparitions and speeches that occur in the works of magicians, it frequently happens that a person obtains knowledge of things surpassing the faculty of his intelligence, such as the discovery of hidden treasure, the manifestation of the future, and sometimes even true answers are given in matters of science. Either, therefore, these apparitions or speeches are not purely imaginary, or at least it is the work of some higher intelligence, and not only of a heavenly body, that a person obtain the aforesaid knowledge through these imaginings. Again, that which is done by the power of heavenly bodies is a natural effect, since they are natural forms that are caused in this lower world by the powers of heavenly bodies. Hence that which cannot be natural to anything cannot be caused by the power of the heavenly bodies. And yet some such things are stated to be caused by the aforesaid works. For instance, it is averred that at the mere presence of a certain person all doors are unlocked, that a certain man become invisible, and many like occurrences are related. Therefore this cannot be done by the power of heavenly bodies. Further, the reception, through the power of heavenly bodies, of that which follows, implies the reception of what precedes. Now movement of its very nature is the result of having a soul, since it is proper to animate things to move themselves. Therefore it is impossible for an inanimate being to be moved by itself, through the power of a heavenly body. Yet it is stated that by the magic art an image is made to move of itself, or to speak. Therefore it is not possible for the effects of the magic art to be caused by a celestial power. And if it be said that the image in question is endowed with some vital principle by the power of the heavenly bodies, this is impossible. For the principle of life in all living things is the substantial form, because, as the philosopher says, in living things to be is to live. Now, it is impossible for anything to receive anew a substantial form, unless it lose the form which it had previously, since the generation of one thing is the corruption of another. But in the making of an image no substantial form is discarded, and there is only a change of shape, which is an accident since the form of copper or something of the kind remains. Therefore, the image in question cannot possibly be endowed with the vital principle. Further, if anything is moved by a principle of life, it necessarily has sensation, for the principle of movement is sensation or understanding. But understanding is not found without sensation in things that come to be and pass away. Now there cannot be sensation where there is not the sense of touch, nor the sense of touch without an organ of mean temperature. Such a temperature, however, is not found in the stone nor wax or metal out of which the statue is made. It is not possible, therefore, that statues of this sort should be moved by a principle of life. Besides, perfect living things are generated not only by a celestial power, but also from seed, for man and the sun generate man, and such as are generated by a celestial power alone without seed, are animals formed by putrefaction, and such belong to a lower grade than the others. Accordingly, if these images be endowed with the vital principle by a celestial power alone, so as to move themselves, it follows that they belong to the lowest grade of animals. And yet this would be false if they worked by an intrinsic principle of life, since among their operations some are of a high degree, for they give answers about hidden things. Therefore it is not possible that their operations and movements proceed from a principle of life. Again, we find sometimes a natural effect produced by the power of heavenly bodies without the operation of art. Thus, although one may produce frogs, or something of the kind by means of some artifice, frogs do happen to be produced without any artifice. Consequently, if these images that are made by necromancy are endowed with the vital principle by the power of heavenly bodies, it will be possible for them to be formed without the operation of art. But this is not the case. Therefore, it is evident that such images have not the principle of life, nor are they moved by the power of heavenly bodies. Hereby we refute the opinion of Hermes, who, according to Augustine, expressed himself thus: as God is the cause of the heavenly gods, so man fashions the gods that reside in temples, being satisfied to live near men. I referred to those animal images, endowed with sense and spirit, that do great and wonderful things, images gifted with knowledge of the future, and who foretell by dreams and many other things, who afflict men with ailments and heal them, who bring sorrow and joy to them according to their merits. This opinion is also refuted by divine authority, for it is said in the Psalm, "The idols of the Gentiles are silver and gold, the works of men's hands. They have a mouth but they speak not, neither is there any breath in their mouths." Yet seemingly we must not absolutely deny the possibility of some kind of efficacy being in these things through the power of the heavenly bodies, but only for such effects as certain lower bodies are able to cause by the power of the heavenly bodies. Chapter 105. Whence the works of magicians derive their efficacy. It remains for us to inquire whence the magic arts derive their efficacy, a question that will present no difficulty if we consider their mode of operation. For in the practice of their art they make use of certain significative words in order to produce certain definite effects. Now, words, insofar as they signify something, have no power except as derived from some intellect, either of the speaker, or of the person to whom they are spoken. From the intellect of the speaker, as when an intellect is of such great power that it can cause things by its mere thought, the voice serving to convey, as it were, this thought to the things that are to be produced. From the intellect of the person to whom the words are addressed, as when the hearer is induced to do some particular thing, through his intellect receiving the signification of those words. Now, it cannot be said that these significative words uttered by magicians derive efficacy from the intellect of the speaker. For since power follows essence, diversity of power indicates diversity of essential principles. Moreover, man's intellect is invariably of such a disposition that its knowledge is caused by things, rather than that it is able by its mere thought to cause things. Consequently, if there be any men that are able of their own power to transform things by words expressive of their thoughts, they will belong to another species, and it would be an equivocation to call them men. Further, by learning we acquire, not the power to do a thing, but the knowledge of how to do it. Yet some, by learning, are rendered able to perform these magic works. Therefore they must have not only good knowledge but also the power to produce these effects. If someone say that these men, by the influence of the stars, are born with the aforesaid power, while others are excluded from it, so that however much the others, who are born without this power, may be instructed, they cannot succeed in performing these works, we reply, first that, as shown above, heavenly bodies cannot make an impression on the intellect. Therefore a man's intellect cannot, through the influence of the stars, receive a power whereby the vocal expression of its thoughts is productive of something. And if it be said that the imagination produces an effect in the utterance of significative words, and that heavenly bodies can work on the imagination, since its operation is performed by a bodily organ, this does not apply to all the results produced by this art. For we have shown that these effects cannot all be produced by the power of the stars. Neither, therefore, can anyone by the power of the stars receive the power to produce those effects. Consequently, it follows that these effects are accomplished by an intellect to whom the discourse of the person uttering these words is addressed. We have an indication of this in the fact that the significative words employed by the magician are invocations, supplications, adjurations, or even commands, as though he were addressing another. Again, certain characters and definite figures are employed in the observances of this art. Now a figure cannot be the principle of either action or passion, else, mathematical bodies would be active and passive. Therefore matter cannot, by definite figures, be disposed to receive a certain natural effect. Therefore magicians do not employ figures as dispositions. It remains, then, that they employ them only as signs, for there is no third solution. But we make signs only to other intelligent beings. Therefore the magic arts derive their efficacy from another intelligent being, to whom the magician's words are addressed. And if someone say that certain figures are appropriate to certain heavenly bodies, and so the lower bodies are determined by certain figures to receive the impressions of certain heavenly bodies, seemingly this is an unreasonable statement. For the patient is not directed to receive the impression of the agent, except through being in potentiality. Hence those things alone determine it to receive a particular impression, that cause it to be somehow in potentiality. Now figures do not cause matter to be in potentiality to any particular form, because a figure, as such, abstracts from all matter and sensible forms, since it is something mathematical. Therefore a body is not determined by figures or characters to receive the influence of a heavenly body. Besides, certain figures are appropriate to heavenly bodies as the effects thereof, for the figures of the lower bodies are caused by heavenly bodies. Now, the aforesaid arts do not use characters or figures as produced by heavenly bodies. In fact, they are produced by man in the practice of the art. Therefore, the appropriateness of figures to certain heavenly bodies has nothing to do with the question. Further, as we have shown, matter is nowise disposed to form by means of figures. Hence, the bodies on which these figures are impressed are as capable of receiving the influence of heavenly bodies as other bodies of the same species. Now, that a thing act on one rather than another of several equally disposed, by reason of something appropriate to be found in it, is a mark of its operating not by natural necessity, but by choice. Hence it is clear that these arts which employ figures in order to produce certain effects, derive their efficacy, not from something that acts by nature, but from some intellectual substance that acts by intelligence. This is also proved by the very name of character which they apply to these figures, for a character is a sign, whereby we are given to understand that they employ these figures merely as signs shown to some intellectual nature. Since, however, in the products of art figures are like specific forms, someone might say that there is no reason why, through the influence of a heavenly body, some power should not shape the figure that gives an image its species, not indeed as a figure, but as specifying the product of art, which acquires this power from the stars. But as to the letters that form an inscription on an image, and other characters, nothing else can be said of them, but that they are signs wherefore they are directed to an intelligence only. This is also proved by the sacrifices, prostrations and other similar practices, which can be nothing else than signs of reverence shown to an intellectual nature. Chapter 106. That the intellectual substance which gives efficacy to the practices of magic is not good according to virtue. We must furthermore inquire what is this intellectual nature by whose power these works are done, and in the first place it is plain that it is not good and praiseworthy, for it is the mark of an ill-disposed mind to countenance things contrary to virtue. Now this is done in these arts, for they are often employed in order to further adultery, theft, murder and like malefices. Wherefore those who practice these arts are called malefics. Therefore the intellectual nature on whose assistance these arts depend is not well disposed according to virtue. Again, it is not the mark of a mind well disposed according to virtue to befriend and assist men of evil life, rather than every upright man. Now those who practice these arts are often men of evil life. Therefore the intellectual nature from whose assistance these arts derive their efficacy is not well disposed according to virtue. Further, it is the mark of a well-disposed mind to guide men towards those goods that are proper to man, namely the goods of reason. Consequently to lead men away from these, and to draw men to goods of the least worth, shows a mind of evil disposition. Now by these arts men progress, not in the goods of reason, which are science and virtue, but in goods of least account, such as the discovery of stolen goods, the capture of thieves, and so forth. Therefore the intellectual substances whose assistance these arts employ are not well disposed according to virtue. Moreover, there is a certain deception and unreasonableness in the works of these arts, for they require a man indifferent to lustful pleasure, whereas they are frequently employed to further lustful intercourse. But there is nothing unreasonable or contradictory in the work of a well-disposed mind. Therefore these arts do not employ the assistance of an intellect that is well-disposed as to virtue. Besides, it is an ill-disposed mind that is incited by the commission of crime to lend his assistance to another. But this is done in these arts, for we read of innocent children being slain by those who practice them. Therefore the persons by whose assistance such things are done have an evil mind. Again, the proper good of the intellect is truth. Since therefore it belongs to good to lead others to good, it belongs to any well-disposed intellect to lead others to truth. In the works of the magicians, however, many things are done by which men are mocked and deceived. The intellect whose help they use, therefore, is not morally well disposed. Further, a well disposed intellect is allured by truth in which it takes delight, but not by lies. The magicians, however, in their invocations make use of various lies, whereby they allure those whose help they employ, for they threaten certain impossible things, as for instance that, unless the one who is called upon gives help, he who invokes him will shatter the heavens or displace the stars, as Porphyry narrates in his letter to Anibans. Those intellectual substances, therefore, with whose help the works of the magicians are performed do not seem to be intellectually well disposed. Moreover, that a superior should be subject as an inferior to one that commands him, or that an inferior should allow himself to be invoked as a superior, would seem to indicate a person of an ill-disposed mind. Now, magicians call upon those whose assistance they employ, as though these were their superiors, and as soon as they appear they command them as inferiors. In no way therefore are they seemingly of a well-disposed mind. Hereby we refute the error of pagans who ascribe these works to the gods. Chapter 107. That the intellectual substance whose assistance is employed in the magic arts is not evil in its nature. It is impossible that there be natural malice in the intellectual substances whose assistance is employed in the practice of the magic arts. For if a thing tends to something by its nature, it tends thereto not accidentally but per se, as a heavy body tends downwards. Now if these intellectual substances are evil essentially, they tend to evil naturally and, consequently, not accidentally but per se. But this is impossible, for we have proved that all things tend per se to good, and nothing tends to evil except accidentally. Therefore, these intellectual substances are not naturally evil. Again, everything that exists must be either cause or caused, otherwise there would be no order between it and other things. Hence the substances in question are either causes only, or are also caused. If they be causes, since evil cannot cause a thing save accidentally, as proved above, and since whatever is accidental must be traced to something per se, it follows that there must be in them something preceding their malice, whereby they are causes. Now in each thing it is the nature and essence that comes first. Therefore these substances are not evil by nature. The same follows if they be caused, for no agent acts except with a good purpose. Therefore evil cannot be the effect of a cause except accidentally. Now that which is caused only by accident cannot exist naturally, since every nature has a definite mode of coming into being. Therefore it is impossible for the substances in question to be evil by nature. Besides, every being has its proper existence proportionate to its nature. Now existence, as such, is good, a sign of which is that all things desire existence. Consequently, if these substances were evil by nature, they would have no existence. Moreover, we have proved that nothing can exist that has not existence from the first being, and that the first being is the sovereign good. Since then every agent, as such, produces its like, whatever proceeds from the first being must be good. Therefore the aforesaid substances, forasmuch as they exist, and have a certain nature, cannot be evil. Further, there cannot possibly exist a thing that is altogether deprived of a participation of good, for since the good and the appetible are the same, if a thing were utterly void of good, there would be nothing appetible in it, and its own existence is appetible to everything. Consequently, if anything be described as evil in its nature, this must be not because it is simply evil, but because it is evil to some person, or in some respect. Thus poison is not evil simply, but to one to whom it is harmful, wherefore one man's poison is another man's meat. Now, this happens because the particular good that is proper to one, is contrary to the particular good that is proper to another. Thus heat, which is the good of fire, is contrary to cold, which is the good of water, and destroys it. Accordingly, that which by its nature is directed, not to this or that good, but to good simply, cannot possibly, even in this way, be called evil by its nature. And such is every intellect, because its good is in its own operation, the object of which is the universal, and things that exist simply. Therefore no intellect can be evil in its nature, either simply or in relation to something else. Again, in every intellectual subject, the intellect moves the appetite, in the natural order, because the proper object of the will is the good understood. Now the good of the will consists in its following the intellect. Thus, in us, good is that which is according to reason, and whatever is beside this is evil. In the natural order, therefore, the intellectual substance wills the good. Consequently, it is impossible that the intellectual substances whose assistance is employed by magical arts be naturally evil. Besides, since the will tends naturally to the good understood, as its proper object and end, it is impossible for an intellectual substance to have a will naturally evil, unless its intellect are naturally in its judgment of good. Now, there can be no such intellect, because false judgments in the acts of the intelligence are like monstrosities in natural things, for they are not according to but beside nature, since the good and natural end of the intellect is the knowledge of truth. Therefore there cannot be an intellect that is naturally deceived in its judgment of truth. Neither, consequently, is it possible for an intellectual substance to have a will naturally evil. Further, no cognitive faculty fails in the knowledge of its object, save on account of being defective or corrupted, since by its very nature it is directed to the knowledge of that object. Thus the sight does not fail in the perception of color, unless the sight itself be injured. Now, every defect and corruption is beside nature, because nature aims at the being and perfection of a thing. Therefore no cognitive faculty can fail in the right judgment of its object. Now, the proper object of the intellect is the true. Therefore there cannot be an intellect that errs naturally in the knowledge of truth. Neither, therefore, can any will stray naturally from the good? This is confirmed by the authority of Scripture, for it is said every creature of God is good, and God saw all the things that he had made, and they were very good. Hereby also we refute the error of the Monachenes, who held that these intellectual substances, whom we are wont to call demons or devils, are naturally evil. We also exclude the error described by Porphyry in his letter to Anibanes, where he says that some are of opinion that there is a genus of spirits, whose speciality it is to grant the prayers of magicians, spirits naturally deceitful, appearing under all kinds of forms, pretending to be gods, or demons, or souls of the departed. It is they who cause all these effects that seem either good or evil. As to those that are really good, they give no assistance, in fact they know nothing about them. But they counsel evil, and impugn and sometimes hinder those who are intent on leading a virtuous life. They are full of presumption and arrogance, they delight in vanities, and are fascinated by flattery. These words of Porphyry indicate clearly enough the malice of the demons, whose assistance the magic arts employ. In this alone are his words reprehensible, that he states this malice to be natural to the demons. Chapter 108. Arguments that would seem to prove that there can be no sin in the demons. Since malice in the demons is not natural to them, and since it has been proved that they are evil, it follows of necessity that the evil in them is voluntary. Accordingly, we must inquire how this can be, because it would seem altogether impossible. For we proved in the second book that no intellectual substance is naturally united to a body, except the human soul, or according to some, the souls of the heavenly bodies. It is unreasonable to deem evil, since the movement of heavenly bodies is most orderly, and, in a sense, is the principle of the entire natural order. Now, every other cognitive power, except the intellect, employs animate corporeal organs. Therefore the substances in question cannot have any cognitive power besides the intellect. Therefore whatever they know they understand. Now one does not err in what one understands, since all error results from lack of understanding. Therefore there can be no error in the knowledge of those substances. But there can be no sin in the will without error, because the will always tends to the apprehended good, so that unless there be error in the apprehension of a good, there cannot be sin in the will. Therefore seemingly there can be no sin of the will in those substances. Again, in us, sin occurs in the will about matters of which we have true knowledge in general, through the judgment of the reason being hindered by a passion that shackles the reason in a particular instance. But there can be no such passions in the demons, because passions belong to the sensitive faculty, which exercises no operation without a corporeal organ. Consequently, if these separate substances have right knowledge in general, it is impossible for their will to tend to evil through defective knowledge in a particular matter. Moreover, no cognitive faculty is deceived about its proper object, but only about one that is outside its purview. Thus the sight is not deceived in its judgment about colors, whereas deception may occur if a man judge by sight of taste, or of the species of a thing. Now, the proper object of the intellect is the quiddity of a thing. Consequently there can be no deception in the knowledge of the intellect, if it were to apprehend the mere quiddities of things, and all deception of the intellect would seem to occur through its apprehending forms mingled with phantasms, as is the case with us. But this mode of knowledge is not in intellectual substances that are not united to bodies, since there can be no phantasms apart from a body. Therefore there can be no error in the knowledge of separate substances, and consequently neither can there be sin in the will. Besides, in us, falsehood occurs in the intellectual operations of synthesis and analysis, through the intellect not absolutely apprehending the quiddity of a thing, and coupling something with the thing apprehended. Now in the operation whereby the intellect apprehends what a thing is, falsehood does not occur except accidentally, insofar as, in this operation also, there is a certain mixture of the intellectual operation of synthesis and analysis. This happens because our intellect attains to the knowledge of the quiddity of a thing, not at once but in a certain order of inquiry. Thus, at first we apprehend animal, then we divide it by opposite differences, and setting one of these aside, add the other to the genus, until we come to the definition of the species. In this process there may be falsehood, if we take as a difference of the genus, one that is not a difference of the genus. Now, to proceed thus to the knowledge of what a thing is, belongs to an intellect that discourses from one thing to another by reasoning and is not becoming to separate intellectual substances, as we proved above. Seemingly, therefore, there can be no error in the knowledge of such like substances and, consequently, neither can there be sin in their will. Moreover, since nothing desires other than its own good, it would seem impossible for that which has but one single good, to err in its appetite. For this reason, although faults happen in natural things through some defect occurring in the execution of the appetite, they never happen in the natural appetite. Thus a stone always tends to a lower place, whether it reach it, or be hindered. Now, in us, sin happens in the act of appetite, because, as our nature is composed of spiritual and corporeal elements, there is more than one good in us. For one thing is our good in relation to the intellect, another is our good in relation to the senses, or in relation to the body. And among these various things that are man's goods there is an order, so that what is of less account must be subordinate to that which is of more account. Hence sin of the will occurs in us, when in defiance of this order, we desire that which is good for us in a restricted sense in preference to that which is good simply. But this composition and diversity of goods is not in separate substances. In fact, their very good is in relation to the intellect. Therefore, seemingly, no sin of the will is possible in them. Again, in us, sin of the will results from excess or deficiency, between which virtue stands. Consequently, in matters that do not admit of excess and deficiency, but only of the mean, the will cannot sin. Thus no man can sin in desiring justice, since justice itself is a kind of mean. Now separate substances cannot desire other than intellectual goods, for it is absurd to say that things by nature incorporeal desire corporeal goods, or that those which have no senses desire sensible goods. But in intellectual goods there can be no excess, for by their very nature they are a mean between excess and deficiency. Thus the truth is a mean between two errors, one of which is on the side of excess, the other on that of deficiency. Wherefore sensible and corporeal goods are in the mean forasmuch as they are according to reason. Therefore, seemingly, intellectual separate substances cannot sin in the will. Moreover, an incorporeal substance is, seemingly, more remote from defects than a corporeal substance. Now, no defect can occur in these corporeal substances that are remote from contrariety, namely the heavenly bodies. Much less therefore can any sin occur in separate substances that are remote both from contrariety, and from matter, and from movement, which seem to be the sources of any possible defect. Chapter 109. That sin is possible in the demons, and how. That sin of the will is in the demons is clear from the authority of Scripture. For it is said that the devil sinneth from the beginning, and it is said that the devil is a liar, and the father of lies, and that he was a murderer from the beginning, and that by the envy of the devil, death came into the world. If anyone chose to follow the opinions of the Platonists, he would easily explain these authorities, for they assert that demons have a body composed of air, and so, since they have a body united to them, there can be a faculty of sense in them. Hence they ascribe to them passions which in us are a cause of sin, namely anger, hate and the like. Wherefore Apuleius says that they are passive in mind. Moreover, independently of their being united to bodies, as the Platonists aver, perhaps yet another kind of knowledge might be assigned to them besides that of the intellect. For, according to Plato, the sensitive soul also is incorruptible, so that it must have an operation in which the body does not concur. Consequently, nothing prevents the operation of the sensitive soul, and therefore the passions, from being in an intellectual substance, even though it be not united to a body. Hence the same source of sin is seated in them as in us. But both of these explanations are impossible, for it has been proved above, that with the exception of human souls no other intellectual substances are united to bodies, and that the operations of the sensitive soul are impossible apart from a body, is clear from the fact, that when a sensorial organ is destroyed, The one operation of the sense is destroyed, thus sight ceases with the loss of an eye. For this reason, as soon as the organ of touch is destroyed, the animal must die, for it cannot live without it. In order to solve the question proposed, then, we must observe that, just as there is order among active causes, so too is there in final causes, so that, to wit, the secondary end depends on the principal end, even as the secondary agent depends on the principal agent. Now, a fault occurs in active causes when the secondary agent strays from the order of the principal agent, just as, when the tibia fails to accomplish the movement commanded by the appetitive power through being crooked, the result is a limping gait. In the same way, therefore, in final causes also, when the secondary end is not subordinate to the principal end, there is sin in the will, the object of which is the good and the end. Now every will naturally desires that which is the proper good of the willer, namely perfect being, nor can it will anything contrary to this. Accordingly, no sin of the will can occur in a willer whose proper good is the ultimate end, which is not subordinate to any other end, and to which all other ends are subordinate. Such a willer is God, whose being is the sovereign good, which is the ultimate end. Therefore in God there can be no sin of the will. But in every other willer, whose proper good must needs be subordinate to another good, sin of the will can occur, if we consider him in his nature. For, though the natural inclination of the will in every will be to will and love his own perfection, so that it cannot will anything contrary thereto, yet it is not naturally implanted in him so that he directs his perfection to another end unfailingly, since the higher end is not his proper end, but that of the superior nature. Wherefore it is left to his discretion to direct his own perfection to a higher end. For beings endowed with a will differ from those which are not so endowed, in that the former direct themselves and what is theirs to an end, wherefore they are said to have free will, whereas the latter do not direct themselves to an end, but are directed by a higher agent, being, as it were, moved to the end by another's action, and not by their own. Hence there could be sin in the will of a separate substance, through his not directing his own good and perfection to his last end, and adhering to his own good as his end. And since rules of action must needs be taken from the end, the consequence was that, through making himself his own end, he pretended to submit other things to his rule, and that his will was not subject to another higher than himself. But this belongs to God alone. In this sense then we are to understand that he desired to be equal to God, not that his good might be equal to the divine good, because such a thing could not come into his mind, and because by desiring it he would desire not to be, since the distinction of species is according to the various degrees of things, as is clear from what has been said above. The will to rule others, and the refusal to submit one's will to the ruling of a superior, is the will to be supreme and, so to say, not to be subject, which is the sin of pride. Hence it is reasonably said that the demon's first sin was pride. But as from one error about a principle, errors various and manifold result, so from the first disorder in the demon's will, there arose all manner of sins in his will, both of hate towards God as resisting his pride, and most justly punishing his fault, and of envy towards man, and of many such sins. We must also observe that, as the proper good of a thing is subordinate to several higher goods, the willer is free to depart from the order of one superior, and not from the order of another that is either higher or lower than the former. Thus a soldier who is subordinate both to his king and to his general, can direct his will to the good of the general, and not that of the king, or vice versa. But if the general depart from the order of the king, the will of the soldier will be good; if he depart from the will of his general, and direct his own will to his king, and the will of the soldier who obeys the will of his general against the will of his king will be evil, because the order of the lower principle depends on the order of the higher. Now, separate substances are not only subordinate to God, but one of them is subordinate to another, from the first to the last, as we proved in the second book. And since in every will under God there can be sin of the will, if he be considered in his nature, it was possible for one of the higher separate substances, or even the highest of all, to sin in his will. And this indeed is not improbable, for he would not have rested in his good as his end unless that good were very perfect. Possibly then, some of the lower separate substances, of their own will, directed their good to him, thus departing from the divine order, and so sinned even as he did, while others adhering, by the movement of their will, to the divine order, rightly departed from the order of the one who sinned, although he was higher than they in the natural order. In the fourth book, we shall show how in either case that will of theirs continues unchangeable, for this regards the punishments or rewards of the good or wicked. There is, however, this difference between a man and a separated substance, that in any one man there are several appetitive powers which are subordinated one to the other. But this is not the case with separate substances, although one substance is subordinated to another. Now sin occurs in the will whenever the inferior appetite is turned aside. Just as sin, therefore, would be brought about in a separate substance either by its being turned aside from the divine order, or because an inferior substance is turned aside from its order to a superior one, which latter remains under the divine order, so in a man sin occurs in two ways. It occurs in one way from the fact that the human will does not direct its proper good to God, and this sin is common both to man and to separate substances. It occurs in another way from the fact that the lower appetite is not regulated with regard to the higher, as for instance when we will the delights of the flesh, towards which the concupiscible appetite tends, not in accordance with reason. But this kind of sin is not found in separate substances. Chapter 110. Solution of the aforesaid arguments. Consequently, it is not difficult to solve the objections that have been raised. For we are not forced to say that there was error in the intellect of the separate substance by judging a good not to be good, but through not considering the higher good to which his own good should have been referred. His will, through being intent on his own good, could be the cause of this lack of consideration, for it is free to the will to turn to this or that. It is also clear that he desired but one good, and that was his own good, but his sin consisted in his disregarding the higher good, to which his own should have been directed. For just as in us there is sin through our desiring inferior goods, those namely of the body, outside the order of reason, so in the devil was there sin through his not referring his own good to the divine. It is also clear that he strayed from the mean of virtue, inasmuch as he did not submit to the order of his superior, and so to himself gave more than his due, and to God less than was due to him, as the sovereign rule to whose order all things should be subject. Consequently, it is evident that in this sin the mean was not missed through excess of passion, but merely through inequality of justice, which is about operations. For in separate substances there can be operations, but passions not at all. Nor does it follow that because in the higher bodies there can be no defects, there can be no sin in separate substances. Because bodies and all irrational beings are acted upon, and do not put themselves in action, for they have no dominion over their actions. Wherefore they cannot escape the first rule that puts them in action and moves them, unless they be unable to receive adequately the rectitude of the supreme rule, owing to an indisposition of matter. Wherefore the higher bodies in which there cannot be any indisposition of matter, can never depart from the rectitude of the first rule. But rational or intellectual substances are not only acted upon, but they also move themselves to their own actions. And this applies to them all the more, according as their nature is the more perfect, since the more perfect a thing's nature, the more perfect is its power for action. Consequently, the perfection of their nature does not prevent the possibility of sin in them in the manner explained above, namely, through adhering to themselves, and disregarding the order of the superior agent. Chapter 111. That rational creatures are subject to divine providence in a special manner. From what has been proved up to now, it is evident that divine providence extends to all things. And yet there must be some special kind of providence bestowed on intellectual and rational creatures, in preference to others. For they surpass other creatures both in the perfections of their nature, and in the excellence of their end. In the perfection of their nature, because alone the rational creature has dominion over its action, since it moves itself freely to act, whereas other creatures are moved to their proper actions rather than act themselves, as was proved above. In the excellence of their end, because alone the intellectual creature by its operation attains to the last end of the universe, namely by knowing and loving God, whereas other creatures cannot attain to the last end except by a certain participation of his likeness. Now, actions vary in kind according to the diversity of end and of their subject matter. Thus in art the operations vary according to the difference of end and matter, for a physician acts differently to expel sickness, and to confirm health, and differently, again in bodies of different temperament. In like manner in the government of a state, a different kind of order must be observed according to the different status of the subjects, and according to the different ends to which they are directed, for there must be a different rule for soldiers to make them ready to fight, and for craftsmen to make them able to work. Accordingly there is one kind of order whereby rational creatures are subject to divine providence, and another whereby other creatures are subject thereto.